Hello and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Jonathan Curiel, author of All America, Travels Through America's Arab and Islamic Roots, and the moderator for today's program, which is titled Not a Proudy, Jihad Jane or Patriot. We welcome our listening audience and invite everyone to find us online at commonwealthclub.org. It is my special pleasure to introduce Nada Prouty. Nada is the author of Uncompromised, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of an Arab-American Patriot in the CIA. Nada Prouty was raised in Lebanon until the age of 19, when she came to the United States to attend school in Michigan. The U.S. became her adopted home, where she became a respected undercover agent, first for the FBI, then for the CIA. She worked on many high-profile terrorism cases until government prosecutors in Detroit accused her of illegally accessing classified information related to Hezbollah. She lost her job and her citizenship and was rescinded. Nada Prouty was eventually exonerated, though, and her story was told to great effect in 2010 on the CBS program 60 Minutes. Nada's book is a memoir and a detailed defense of her character and her years as an undercover agent. It sets the record straight, she says, in all matters of her life. Please welcome Nada Prouty.
Thank you.
In reading your book, Uncompromised, it does tell a pretty incredible story that if you didn't think it was real, you'd think it was total fiction. In some ways, your life is one of the most incredible lives that people will probably meet this literary year. And I say that having read the book and having traveled a lot in the Middle East and understanding your life in ways that I think are possible through your book. And what I'd like you to do, Nada, is first of all set the stage for the book and for your life, really. You know, there is a lot of cinematic detail, in a sense, that's in your book. But can you set the stage for us and where this all began, really?
Sure. I opened the book. I don't know. First of all, let me ask, how many people have read the book here? Okay, so not a lot of people, and I understand that it just came out. So I open up the book with a scene. It was 2003 in Baghdad, and I was a CIA covert operations officer, and I was given a mission to exit from the green zone, get outside, gather intelligence, and come back and report the intelligence. So I got a call that day from a contact, and the contact told me that he needed to see me immediately. I told him I would, and I did just that. And there's a process when you leave the green zone. So I got my Glock, I got my Colt Commando, I've got my handheld radio, I've got my GPS, and I got my bulletproof vest. And within the green zone, I drove from one area to the other where I picked up a junker car. The reason I wanted to drive a junker car is because I did not want my SUV to be highlighted outside the green zone, because you would be known as American and you would be targeted. So I get in my junker car, I get out of the green zone, I conduct the meeting, I gather intelligence. And at that time, intelligence was really important because it was about planned attacks. So we wanted to give information to our troops that are patrolling the streets, enough information for them not to be targets of attacks, whether it's a sniper, whether it's a explosion, whatever it was. So I get out, I finish the mission, I'm on my way back. And at that time in 2003, cars would line up right outside of the green zone and they would be ushered in, one car at a time. They would ask you for your ID and all of that. And my car broke down right at the entrance of the green zone. So I radioed for help, and the other thing that I had an abaya to disguise all my weapons and hide all my stuff, and to hide the baby because I was pregnant too. So I radioed for help, and I was waiting for help. And the Iraqis are all parked behind me, and they're just beeping, "Get out of the way!" And you're yelling at me. And I did not want to get out of the car because I didn't want them to see my weapons. So one at a time, I usher them, and they pass, and I was the last car. Then I see him. It was a Marine looking at me suspiciously. I was in a suspicious car, and he didn't know why I had been parked there for such a long time. So he starts approaching me one step at a time. My heart's beating, and I said to myself, oh, my God, you know, I think he thinks I'm the bad guy. So he gets his weapon. He still hasn't pointed it at me yet, and he's walking towards me, and he's saying, "Get out of the car, get out of the car." And I'm saying, you know, I'm rolling down the window that doesn't really work, and I'm screaming, I'm American, I'm American. There was nobody there at the time to see me, but I was screaming because I wouldn't scream that way in front of the Iraqis. So I'm screaming, I'm American, I'm American. And I thought, oh, let me grab my badge, which is tucked deep down inside under my bulletproof vest and all my disguise. So as soon as I grab my badge, what is he thinking? I'm going to blow him up. I'm pulling a detonator, and I'm going to blow him up. So he lifts his weapon, points it right in my face. Finger that was resting on the frame of the gun moves right to the trigger, and he is ready to shoot me. He's sweating. I could see the sweat. I'm drenched in sweat. You would think I just got out of the shower. And I kept saying, okay, I put my hands up. I thought I was going to die, but I didn't. So I put my hands up, and I started talking to him. I said, let me reach for my badge. 1 second, let me reach for my badge. And just engaging him in this conversation gave him a little pause. So I slowly reached out, and I got the badge, and I showed it to him. He's shaking a little bit. I'm trembling like a leaf. And then he says, welcome to the green zone, and he lets me in. Yes, it was very welcoming. But this is back in 2003, and these are the circumstances for both the CIA officers that would leave, the safety of the green zone to collect intelligence, and the circumstances for our men and women in military. You really don't know. So after that incident, we changed the way that when we approach the green zone to give the folks that are protecting the green zone to let them know basically that we are the good guys. I can't tell you how we changed it, but I can tell you that we did change it. So that's how I open up the book. Would you like me to continue about different?
Well, I would like you to continue because your life seems like it's out of like a cross between the Bourne adventure series and maybe Syriana, you know, something like that. But I also want to remind people listening and also in the audience that you studied to be an accountant, I believe, right? And so one of the curious things, and curious is maybe an understatement here, about your book is that you, in a sense, you're not only a fish out of water, you're many fish out of water, you know? So the fact that you're in Baghdad is we take it for granted, but no, we shouldn't take that for granted. You were studying to be an accountant. A professor actually told you maybe you might want to think about a career in the FBI. And at that point, you had been in this country, I don't know how many years, five or so years or so. So you hadn't thought about, saving lives on such a global scale, but here you were actually saving lives, but also having your life in jeopardy. And I think that's where a lot of the tension comes from. You are saving American lives. But it would be great if you could just talk about your need to join the FBI and the CIA.
Yeah. I'll back up a little bit.
Sure.
To give the folks a little bit of an understanding. I was born in Lebanon, and it's a war-torn country for the folks who do not know a lot about Lebanon. And I was also born to an abusive father. So when I was attending the American University of Beirut, when the last round of bombing closed up the school, so I decided to apply and come to the States and get my education. My thought at the time is I was going to come to the States, I was going to get educated, and I was going to go back to Lebanon and show people. I was going to get a job. I was going to become independent. So I had all these dreams about the changes and the impact that I would make on people going back. But I came to the States, and I started studying at Detroit College accounting, and at one point of time, my parents did not financially support me. The other thing that my dad had planned for me was an arranged marriage. So I did not want to be part of that arranged marriage. And when I came here, my father did not financially support me. And as you know, the foreign student tuition is very expensive. I was working as a waitress. I was making a whole $2.50 an hour. And so I tried to make ends meet, and I tried to save as much money. I ate the leftover foods of the customers because I just couldn't afford to buy food. And I shoveled snow, and I did everything possible, but I was not able to afford the college student tuition. So going back, I went back to the Arab American community. I was in Dearborn, Michigan, and you get a lot of advice from the Arab American community. To give you an example of one of the pieces of advice that we'd get, we were told in Lebanon that Americans do not accept Arabs on public transportation, so we were scared to go on public transportation. And my roommate at the time decided that she wanted to buy a car and we can drive. So we went to the Arab American community, asked them a question about, okay, how do we buy a car? Where do you go? How do you do it? And they said, well, the cheapest cars are in auctions. So there we go. We go get this car. We're so happy. It's a Ford Mustang GT with tinted windows. It worked, but that's not the bad part. The car gets there. It's an auction, as is. You buy it. You give them the money. We opened the doors to the car. It was gutted on the inside. There was nothing there. There was only, the only thing was there was a steering wheel. So, not knowing any better, we decided we were going to make this work. We cannot afford to do anything. So we put beach chairs inside the car and stuck pillows on the back, and we drove that thing forever. Thank God for the tinted windows, because the police officer, I don't know, I just can imagine the look on his face or her face if they stopped us. But that's kind of the life of an immigrant. You get a lot of advice, and one of the advice was, if you go to the hospital and you want to cut in line, always tell them you have heart problems. They'll take you right in. So just one thing after the other. And when I went back to the American Arab community, and I was talking to a colleague, and I said, I can't afford the college tuition. I've done everything I can. I work every hour that I'm not in school. I'm working. What can I do? So the advice started coming. One of them's like, if you sell drugs, you don't have to do drugs, but if you sell drugs, you'll make a lot of money. I'm like, no, I don't want to do that. Another advice like, I bet you make a lot more tips if you work as a topless dancer. I'm like, no, I did not want to do that. And finally, someone said, well, if you marry an American citizen, you would be considered a resident. And the resident, you would be paying the resident tuition. You wouldn't be paying this, you know, super high tuition. So things got really bad, and I don't want to tell you everything in the book, but things got really bad, and I ended up doing just that. But now coming back to the point that you were making, after staying in the country, the one thing I did not plan on is falling in love with America. And I hadn't thought about it when I first came here. I hadn't really considered living in the States for the rest of my life. So, but it was the everyday thing that I fell in love with. I was free to say whatever I wanted. A cousin of mine had criticized the Syrians and the next day disappeared, was killed. We don't know to this date what happened to him. So I was free to express my opinion. I was free to wear whatever it is that I wanted to wear. I was just between the freedom, the democracy that we have here. And it's hard for someone who has not had these in love feelings with the country of their birth to explain it. And I guess the best way I could say it is, if you haven't experienced injustice, you really don't know what justice is. So anyways, I decided to go through with the sham marriage. And after falling in love with the States, I decided that I wanted to give back to the country that took me in. No one told me, because you're a woman, you have to stand a different line. No one, I mean, I just love the vibrancy of our community. No one looks at you and thinks of you differently because you're a woman or because of your ethnic background. We're just a big melting pot, and I was accepted so well into this. So I decided I wanted to give back to my adopted country and serve my adopted country. So I applied to the FBI and was accepted for the position of special agent. Now, the one mention I want to make, I did list that sham marriage on that first page of my FBI application, and I called them to discuss the circumstances, and I was told not to worry about it. So for the 2 years that it took to complete my FBI background, this never came up. So I thought that they had adjudicated it, and they had accepted me for, even though with my, you know, past ill will or bad deed, they've accepted me. And it wasn't a strange thing for me, because on the application at the time, the standards were, if you've done marijuana 15 times or less, you can still apply to the FBI. Or if you've done hardcore drugs 3 times or less, you could still apply for the FBI. So I thought, okay, well, I've made a mistake. I was 19, and so I applied, and they took me in. But when I first got there, because I was an accounting student, I thought, here I am, I'm ready to sit on a desk, and I'm going to chase the money. I'm going to find out where people are hiding the money. But instead of chasing the money, I ended up chasing the terrorist. A little bit switch in there for an accountant, from desk work to actually being out on the field. Because I was assigned a squad that investigated crimes against U.S. citizens and U.S. interests overseas. And within just a couple of months after I got there, I was interviewing Hani Sayel. He was indicted for his role in the 1996 Khobar Tower bombings, where 19 of our servicemen died. And shortly after that, I was in London also on the investigation, the 1998 kidnapping of U.S. citizens and British tourists in Yemen. And then after that, it was the USS Cole. I arrived there the day after the bombing. And then I can't even remember. So I had so many different cases. The two other cases that come to the top of my head were the 2003 bombing of three apartment buildings in targeting Americans in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. And I also, the last assigned case was the 2002 assassination of, I'm sure some of you remember here, Lawrence Foley, USA diplomat in Amman, Jordan, was gunned down in front of his house by what the plot was planned by Abu Mu'tab al-Zarqawi, who later became very famous for his role in the Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So I did a lot of these FBI investigations, reporting to the crime scene, bag tag. Obviously, I worked on the 9/11, the Pentagon. My office was a little less than 5 miles from the Pentagon, and I worked, arrived to the Pentagon to secure the scene to start conducting the investigation.
A reminder to our listening audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Nada Prouty, author of the book Uncompromised, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of an Arab American Patriot in the CIA. So far, Nada, you've talked about the rise part. You've hinted at the fall part as well, the fall part relating to your teenage marriage coming here. Can you get into a little bit of the fall part?
Sure.
And the fall in this sense is of you being accused falsely in so many ways of betraying the country, and accused by people who it turns out had a political agendas. But can you talk about that as best you can here?
Sure. I just want to set up. So in 2003, where I left with the last investigation in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, I had been exposed a lot to CIA officers overseas because my work was about 90% overseas. So I was exposed a lot to the CIA officers. And it wasn't until a conversation that I had with one of them that told me, so you work for the FBI, you come and investigate crimes overseas. And I said, yes. And he said, you arrive after the fact. And we had this banter back and forth. And then finally I got to the point that he was making. I arrived to the scene after the fact. He's like, why don't you join the CIA where you can collect intelligence to prevent that attack so people don't have to come here and do this investigation? And I did, and I applied to the CIA, and I joined the CIA, and I started telling you guys a 2003 story in Baghdad. And I worked for the CIA for a number of years, and basically, I came back to the CIA headquarters, and I was getting ready to go on a second place where I can't tell you where it is. But I was learning Farsi, and I became fluent Farsi speaker. And then this is when the fall happened. I was doing such a great job for the CIA at headquarters that I was getting kudos from the White House. So we'll talk about the fall. You basically start, set it up. Federal prosecutors in Detroit had this vision, dream, I don't know what to say, that I was guilty of passing intelligence to the terrorist group Hezbollah. They didn't have any evidence. And I didn't know why they were going after me at the time. Until later did I figure out that there was a political motivation behind it. And so they started with their investigation, and they did all the techniques that I'm, having been on the inside, that I'm familiar with. These techniques are, long investigation. It drains you out of your financial resources. As someone as a government worker, let me tell you, we don't make a lot of money. You know, you really have to love your country and have your heart in the mission to do that kind of work. So, as you know, that was the first thing. So, draining us out of our financial resources, and they were, you know, it was one threat after the other. Went after my family, went after my friends, and to put a lot of pressure for me to basically plead guilty to something I did not do. A couple of other threats were they devised a scheme where every time I've used my U.S. passport to travel overseas on the government's behalf to be in harm's way, every time that I've used my U.S. passports, they were going to charge me with a felony because it's fraudulent use of a U.S. passport. And they were very proud to have counted the hundreds of times that I've traveled on the government's behalf. And that was going to put me in jail for the rest of my life. So they were very proud that they were able to do that. And I fought, and I fought. I'm like, I can't say, you know, that I did, that I'm going to do something I didn't do. How could you, you know? And deep down, I guess, I was very torn. Why would I say I believe in the justice system? Why would I, in a sense, betray the justice system and say that I did something that I didn't do? But the last threat came through, and that threat was, we're going to deport you to Lebanon, and we're going to tell everyone that you worked for the FBI and the CIA. So for anyone slightly familiar with what that really means, it is plain and simple. It's a death threat. And I had a child, and I had a lot of guilty feelings because I had put that my child, my you know baby girl's life in danger in Baghdad for so long. I was shot at several times, and I remember when we'd get out of the green zone or would be on a mission or wherever it is, she'd be kicking left, right, and center. It's like, be careful, Mom. So, you know, I had a lot of guilty feelings, and that caused a lot of stress on her. She could read body language. Kids are very good at that. So when I had to make a decision. I had to make a decision as a mom. I had to make a decision as a wife. And I had to make a decision whether I would be killed or not. Who was going to raise my daughter? I had already thought about that once before when I was in Baghdad. And I had to have that discussion. If I get killed and they save the baby's life, I wanted to name, you know, I wanted to give them a name of who I wanted to raise my child. So I felt very, very guilty. And with that last threat, I pled guilty. I pled guilty to the immigration charges to which the statute of limitation had long expired, and that I honestly had listed it on my application. I thought everybody knew about it. This new discovery where they, you know, we just discovered this. It just made no sense to me. But that was part also of, you know, twisting your arm to plead guilty to something you didn't do. And the other charge that I pled guilty to was accessing an FBI system without authorization. But that wasn't enough for them. They went to the media. They leaked all kinds of information to the media that I was a spy for Hezbollah. And that was a very rough period for my family. The press were camped outside of our house for weeks at a time. Neighbors would not talk to me. My daughter, who was stressed, I would drop her off at the school, and I wanted to talk to a teacher. I wanted to tell them, you know, my kid is stressed, and they wouldn't talk to me. They just walk away from me. And no, I mean, friends, both from the FBI and the CIA, not all of them, but some of them just wouldn't want to talk to me. And it was very, very rough time. So I've set up the fall. Are we ready to go back to the rise or the redemption?
Yeah, we are. And this is a time to take a question from the audience, because this relates to your redemption. The question from the audience is, do you know Valerie Plame, who was outed as an undercover agent? And of course you do, because she wrote a blurb for the back of your book, and the blurb reads as a little bit as follows. Not a proudie, served her country loyally with distinction, and as universally acknowledged by her colleagues, with great personal courage as a CIA covert officer. Now, like Valerie Plame, you know, who's also went through a kind of redemption as well, your redemption has been not without some low points. And in fact, this book, among the things it does, is gets into these very, you know, very detailed complications. But there has been a redemption, and part of it, I have to say that the redemption was instigated by you as well. I mean, and the redemption, for example, starts with a 60 Minutes profile of you. Why did they do that? Because you approached them. No one else did. You said, I want to rescue my name. I want to rescue my life from these people who are, in a sense, taking my life away. They're taking away everything I've worked for. And so this is one of the things about your book, and I think about you, that a lot of people will admire, and that is, you know, you don't give up. And instead of, you know, having your father arrange a marriage for you, you arranged your own marriage.
Right.
That's what you did. And in a sense, you know, you are, you know, the take charge person that I think represents America. Now, that might be a little be going a little bit overboard, but let's have you talk about your redemption now, please.
Yes. So I pled guilty, and it was a really bad time. And then the CIA conducted an investigation. And if anybody knows, or you don't want to be part of a CIA counterintelligence investigation, basically it was 2 weeks of, I had to explain everything from the day that I was born until the day that I was talking to the CIA officer. They concluded with the investigation, and they, you know, sitting in the room with them and asking me questions, and they would be shaking their heads, and, you know. Anyways, they concluded the investigation. There are two parts of the investigation. The first part is the unclassified part, and it's available as part of the public record, and I was exonerated. And the second part, which is the classified part that I don't have access to, it's classified. But in it, the former CTC chief on 60 Minutes alludes to it, and he said she was completely exonerated. Even after I was exonerated, and then the federal judge, the day of my sentencing, I was sentenced $750 for an investigation that cost the taxpayers, I want to just estimate it, hundreds of thousands of dollars for $750. Anyway, it's not a good return on your investment from an accounting standpoint here. So the judge, the day of the sentencing, he had requested additional information from the prosecutor's office. For example, he said, okay, she pled guilty to viewing a document. Did she print it out? No, she didn't print it out. He started asking more and more questions, and he had come to the conclusion this really was a setup. So the day of the sentencing, it was a movie scene. I'm standing in front of the judge. He rebuked the prosecution team. And here's the media. The media had, you know, the prosecutor's office, every 2 or 3 months they would leak some more information to the media. And all of it would start all over again. So on that day, all of the media is in the court. The judge had letters that were written on my behalf from FBI agents, from CIA officers, from people that have supported me from day one, from higher-ups. I can't tell you who they are, but very senior CIA folks. He took that, and he looked at the media, and he said, for anyone of you here that wants to write about Nada Prouty, poof, he throws it at them. He said, read this before you write anything. And so you would think after, you know, all of this, after all these exonerations, things would change. But that actually angered the prosecutors. So they started putting more pressure on me. Example of more pressure, they said that I was not allowed to travel outside 50-mile radius from my home. They froze my bank accounts. Just playing games, just the different, yes. You would think, like, wow, she's been exonerated, now this is all good. No, I believe that they were so afraid that the truth is going to come out and expose them, that they wanted to put so much pressure on me that I would leave to Lebanon and, you know, disappear. The truth will disappear with me. Anyways, I finally decided, for a CIA officer, you're trained to avoid the media. So it was very, very hard decision for me to return the call from 60 Minutes, because everybody under the sun had called me and they wanted to have an interview. Every show, every radios, TV shows from overseas, and I had refused to talk to anyone. I wanted to give the government the chance to correct its actions. I had refused to talk to anyone. Finally, I decided, you know what? I have given everybody a chance to correct what has happened, and nobody was doing it. I was just forgotten. So I contacted 60 Minutes, and I didn't know it at that time, but I was told, you get on 60 Minutes for two reasons. You're really, really good, or you're really, really bad. And they thought I was really, really bad. So, and they conducted an investigation too, and when they saw all the information that was out there, they were, you know, they are not supposed to show their feelings, and I think, deep down in my heart, they were, you know, I could just feel that their blood was boiling. So I appeared on 60 Minutes, and shortly after that, people looked back into the case. They reviewed what has happened. And this past December, the Attorney General, the director of the CIA, and the Secretary for Homeland Security all signed a memo to grant me back my U.S. person status, because part of the deal is I was stripped from my U.S. citizenship. So they all signed a memo to grant me back my, and I'm currently pursuing my U.S. citizenship. And I tell people who ask me, you know, I tell them today that piece of paper would be a great thing, but deep down in my heart, I've been American from the day that I've set foot here. I've always been American, and I feel more American today than I've ever felt before.
A reminder to our listening audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Nada Prouty, author of the book Uncompromised, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of an Arab-American Patriot in the CIA. You still have a very long life ahead of you. You haven't even, you know, reached the halfway point, I would safely say. So you have a lot of years left, and I know a lot of people wondering, what are you going to do next? What are you doing now? We have one of the questions from the audience is, wow, your life is so amazing already. Have you approached Hollywood about making a movie out of it? And my guess is yes.
And you are right.
can you just talk a little bit about that? But maybe perhaps in terms of your ongoing process of redemption, because it's really part of the same process, correct?
Yes. You know, people have asked me, why did you write a book? And why are you publicly talking about it? And I tell them because, first and foremost, when I first started writing the book, I wanted my daughters. I have a 7-year-old and a 3-year-old monster. And so I wanted them, when they are old enough to read and understand what happened, I wanted them to know the truth. That was, you know, one of the most important reasons I wanted to write the book. And I also wanted to write it because I want to share with my fellow citizens my experience, because I think we can all learn from this. And, you know, one of the lessons that I personally have learned, and I hope that everyone, you know, feels the same way I do. People say now, oh, so you're anti-government. And I tell them, no, I am not. I have worked next to FBI agents, I have worked next to CIA officers of the highest moral standards. I have worked with military, I've seen the sacrifices, I've seen the influence on the family. And I do not dislike or have any ill will or hatred towards my government. I love the government. There are bad apples in the government, and we need, you know, to highlight those bad apples so this thing does not happen again. But it's not a reflection on the hard work of the folks that I've worked it with. I remember a friend of mine who left to serve in Iraq, and her son got so irritated that his mom had left and kept rubbing his ear until he opened it, and they had to stitch it back on. There are a lot of sacrifices that family members go through from their children, whether it's children, whether it's wives that are left behind, or whoever it is. And if I said yes, all the government is bad, I would be doing the same exact thing that the prosecutors did, because they thought I was Muslim and I'm Catholic, and they thought that all Muslims are bad. So these were in the view of the prosecutors, you know, I'm not going to do what they did. I'm not going to follow in those bad footsteps. So I'm very proud to have served my government, and if I'm called to serve it again, I'll do that tomorrow at a drop of a dime. I have no problems whatsoever. So I hope I can get that message through. It's the bad apples. It's not a reflection on all the good people that I have worked with.
And related to the question about movie rights and so forth, I mean, a lot of your book takes place in the streets of capitals, where you're actually dealing with people who are pointing guns at you, the aftermath of terrorist incidents and so forth. But a lot of the book also takes place in rooms like this one, where you're interviewing people who have confessed or are about to confess. And this is a lot. There's a lot of drama in these rooms. And for example, one of the people you interview in the book is Zayed Hassan Safarini, mm-hmm. who was responsible for a terrible bombing, Pan Am Flight 73 in Karachi in 1986. And you not only meet him in a jail room and essentially get him to confess, you also meet him, I believe, in Thailand, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Where essentially you are involved in a dramatic rendition where he is actually taken to the United States very swiftly, and he's now, I believe, serving in Colorado. But can you talk about these intense moments where you're actually face-to-face with people, where it's not, you know, the street and guns, it's you one-on-one or one-on-two or two-on-one with people, and there's a lot of there's a lot of complicated feelings, including people who say you as an Arab person are betraying the Arab cause. I mean, Safarini, I believe, is Palestinian.
Correct. Yes, I have had the, I don't want to say pleasure, the opportunity to sit, you know, face to face in a small room with a number of terrorists. And, you know, I'm a little bit hyper, so I want to get the confession, but I do slow down when I'm conducting an interrogation. And, you know, you really have to, something that we really don't give a lot of credit to, you really have to understand the person that you're sitting across from. In order to get a confession, in order to, whatever it is that you're doing, even if it's a witness, you have to understand the person that you're sitting across from. Safarini being one of them. If you don't understand your subject, it's a lot easier if you talk in the language that they talk. So speaking Arabic has really opened a lot of doors. But it's cultural understanding too. And, you know, I can't even stress enough about the importance of culture and understanding your adversary, or not necessarily adversary, to build that relationship that allows you to get to where you want to get. I remember one of them, and you mentioned Safarini, but I also remember in Saudi Arabia, I was getting ready to interview the main witness who had witnessed the whole entire attack on the Singh compound that killed Americans. And it was a Saudi male. They brought him to us. He was about this tall. And he came in. He's nervous. I'm a woman. I'm sitting with another FBI agent. And I sat down. I mean, he sat on the ground. I sat right next to him. He wanted to talk about his subject. I talked to him. Just, you know, understanding that, you know, the other agent that was sitting with me, and the guy sitting on the floor had his, you know, the sole of his foot on his face, which, and for anyone that understand this, I'm like, oh, I'm trying to alert him. We're trying to, you know, get the witness to talk here. Let's not make him too nervous. But, you know, I think, you know, if I have to sum it up, the importance of language, the importance of culture. Safarini walked in and he's yelling at me, and he's like, "Do you think the life of a Palestinian is not as worth as the life of someone from Israel?" And, you know, I knew that I could not engage with him in these debates about whose life is worth more. And, you know, I've heard them growing up in Lebanon all my life. I've heard these types of arguments. They're futile. They don't make any sense. So I had to shift from that and draw on his, what he wanted to do. He'd been in Rawalpindi, Pakistani jail for 17 years. And I knew that I could get him to talk if I got him in the right path. So I, you know, my background has helped a lot. And, you know, arriving in Baghdad and being born in a country with bombs every other day, that kind of helped me. I wasn't as scared. I was kind of used to it. Yeah, I don't know. You do get used to bombs.
Right. You say you do get used to bombs. And on the other hand, you talk in the book about witnessing, for example, airplanes, military jets crashing and firing bombs, and how scary it was. You do get used to it. But in a sense, growing up in Lebanon, you know, you were part of a bigger, of course, community, a bigger country, but you were raised in the Druze tradition, right?
Correct.
And one of our audience members would like to ask you about, you know, the sense of being Druze and where that situates you in the overall religious scene. And I think that's a relevant question, because in a sense, a Druze is a minority within a country that doesn't really tolerate minorities. It does and it doesn't. I mean, Druze are often seen as being a sect of Islam, when in fact it's much more complicated than that. And one final thing I'll just say, you talked about converting to Catholicism. I mean, how did that play into your, you know, Americanism, as it were?
Sure. You know, there's not a good description to explain the Druze. They're kind of, you know, and I was not brought up Druze, but it's a combination of Christianity, Islam, and Buddhism. So it's a combination of all these religions, but it's a secretive religion. And, excuse me, so, you know, I did not grow up Druze. I didn't practice the faith. In fact, I don't know a lot about the faith. You receive your, you receive information about the Druze lived at the wise age of 40. So I, you know, my parents did not practice it. I went to an evangelical school as a child, and this is when I embraced Christianity as a child. And what was the second part?
Oh, right. Well, so just in the sense of, you know, you're sort of a minority in Lebanon. And so you're, in a sense, you're used to being the outsider. And as a woman, especially when you're treated, the book goes into great detail about how you were mistreated. But not only by your parents, both your mother and father, but by the culture, in a sense.
Yes, the culture views women as second-class citizens. Whether it's as kids, and one of the stories that I described was, you know, the boys are allowed to bully the girls because this is how they earn their, dominance. And in our home, personally, in our home, it went a little bit further. So my brother is the youngest, and in order to allow him to learn how to become a good, strong male, my parents would hold us down, the girls, and allow him to beat us. But that's kind of the culture that I grew up with. And I take the positive out of that. I think it's what made me a survivor, and I think, that's the one thing the Detroit prosecutors did not count on. It's my ability to survive. They thought, with enough pressure, she'll disappear, nobody will know. And it is my ability to survive. And I take the positive from growing up in such a culture, demeaning to women, and growing up with an abusive family. And I have taken the positive out of that, and I just use it for my daily survivor. And how not to be a good parent, how not to be a parent from my parents.
A reminder to our listening audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Nada Prouty, author of the book Uncompromised, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of an Arab American Patriot in the CIA. We've talked about the rise, we've talked about the fall, we've talked about the redemption. In some ways, all these things circle back for certain people. There are some people who say, despite your redemption, we still don't trust you. Let's not name names, but you can name names if you want. But they're out there. If you do a Google search on Nada Prouty, you'll find them. You'll also find, I'm afraid, some really good photos of you, but also I believe a booking photo, something like that, mm-hmm. Right? So it's all out there swirling about, and as we talked earlier, this book is about setting the record straight, and yet, for example, one person in the audience wants to know more about why you were targeted. Was it because of the environment in post 9/11? Was it because you were Arab American? Was it because, other reasons? Can you talk about that again?
Yes, I'll answer that question, but actually, let me just go ahead and answer that question. I describe that in detail in the book. The United States Attorney, this is my belief, the United States Attorney had twice tried to get a judicial appointment in Michigan and failed. And I believe the reason he failed is because he did not have enough national security credentials, just, criminal cases, but not enough national security credentials. So in order to get his national security credentials, this is the national security credential right here. And I believe I was targeted for that. There was an element of racism also in the investigation. And I don't use racism just, for any reason. I had the assistant United States attorney not looked me in the face and tell me, aren't all Shia in Detroit supporters of Hezbollah? I would have never used it. So having this view that these Muslims are all supporters of a terrorist group, this is what I was experiencing. These are the people that I was dealing with. So I think these, between a political and between a little bit of racism, these two angles are, why I was targeted.
And still being the target of people.
Yes.
They tend to resurrect old, you can almost call them cliches.
Right. Yes. And to answer the second part of your question is, yes, if you Google my name, there's still a lot of bad stuff. But I tell you this, and people have asked me about that before. When I was on the front line, when I was taking bullets, I was doing this so that each and every person in our country is free and can express their opinion. I didn't say, I'm only doing this for a certain crowd of people that support me. whether their opinion is for me or against me. This is America, and you can express their opinion. You know, I hope that their opinions are based in facts, and if they're not, you know, they're not. But I, you know, people who have and continue to say negative things about me, you know, I tell them I'm glad I was able to give you a stage where you can express your true opinion.
And it must be kind of surreal for you to be, having been a CIA agent, you know, undercover agent, to be behind the scenes, to do these things behind the scenes, to you know, in a sense, save America, save American lives, to now be on the other end where you're actually so publicly, you know, in the spotlight. And I'm wondering if you have people, even, you know, friends of yours who are still in the CIA and FBI, who, in a sense, respect and admire you even more now for being out in the spotlight, for doing something that really most CIA and FBI agents never actually do.
Yes, a good friend of mine described becoming not outed, but you're in a covert position, and when you're senior enough and when you're ready to leave the service, you can change your status from a covert to an overt officer. And somebody that I know described it's like dropping trowel. It's really, all your life you've lived in the shadows, in the dark, and now it's so hard to say, I had to train myself to say the word CIA in front of people, because all my life I've been trained not to use these words, not to mention my employment, and I'm trained to be in the back, and now being on center stage, that's, very stressful from my training perspective. I'd much rather have a machine gun and go to a war zone. It's a lot easier for me than being on a stage in addressing people and saying those three-letter words.
One of the questions that people, an audience member has asked is about your conversion to Catholicism. But in your book, you talk about God several times, if more than several times. And after 9/11, here's a quote from the book. You say, "I realized I was angry with God." So as someone who is newly religious, you could say, and has seen the best and worst of humanity, can you talk about the world after 9/11 in terms of your own religious faith, or even the idea of religious faith, whether it's even possible?
Well, to me, I felt after 9/11, I had a lot of anger. I think a lot of people felt that way, but I had anger with a number of issues. I had anger with how could we have prevented this? You know, is it my fault? Should I have worked a little harder? Should I have done something more? Instead of working 12 hours, should I have put in 15 hours? And I felt guilty, but I felt angry. And I felt angry that these terrorists took advantage. They come to this country and took advantage of our freedom and used it, and, you know, took control of planes and used it to destroy us. I was very angry, and what I wanted to do is, again, use my weapon and go to Afghanistan and just eliminate anyone and everyone that I could see. But the other thing that I was angry with is I was angry with God. Why would God let this happen? These people are innocent. They have nothing to do with the political situation. And why did this happen? And I questioned my faith at the time. But I guess it's a process. And my conversion to Catholicism is, I don't know who asked, so I can look at them directly. My conversion into Catholicism, I had, you know, practiced the, embraced Christianity as a child. And then when I converted, my husband is Catholic, and I wanted to have my children grow up in a religion. When I grew up, I did not have, we didn't practice anything at home. So, and I know how important it is. It doesn't matter what religion it is, but I know how important it is to have that religion given to your children. It grounds them, and I wish that I had practiced something as a child. So this is why, and I obviously do believe in the teachings of Catholicism.
Now, a lot of religious faiths teach people that when you're in a different country, you don't have to go to your traditional house of worship. You can go to a mosque, you can go to a synagogue, you can go anywhere. So that religion, in that sense, is malleable. And your life, in a sense, you've gone to different countries. You've experienced a part of the world that most people read about. Pakistan, Yemen, Saudi Arabia. You were in Rwanda as well. You spent some time in Rwanda. And in fact, you were pregnant, I believe, in Rwanda for the first time.
Right.
Can you talk about, for example, how a lot of people would see as Africa as being completely different from the Middle East in so many ways, politically, in military ways. But did you find that Africa in that Rwanda was familiar to you? Or was there something else that maybe made you realize, wow, look how different the world is?
All the countries that I've traveled and all the places that I've seen, there's one thing that I found in common, and it's people. Humans are the same wherever you go. In the general picture, people naturally are good doers. They want to do good. They want to help. And whichever country that I was in, Rwanda or, whichever country I happened to be, I used to wake up and say, where am I today? So I did find that, unfortunately, most of the reasons that I was in these countries were not, were for bad things because somebody had been assassinated, killed, murdered, kidnapped. The reasons that took me there are not what I believe the people in those countries were, and generally people are wanted to help and do good. So it was in Rwanda when I discovered that I was pregnant the first time. And I remember I was in Rwanda Hotel. There was a movie made about it, so for people who have seen that. And I remember walking to the pharmacy there and getting a pregnancy test, and I wanted to share that with my husband. So I put it in an FBI bag, and I sealed it as if it's evidence, and I handed it to him, and this is how he learned that I was pregnant. A little bit different.
We just have probably a few more minutes here, but speaking of air travel and so forth, you in the book you describe how the U.S. government gave you something to transport from Pakistan into the United States, and what they told you this was perhaps anthrax.
Right? Yes, I discussed that. Right after September 11, I was deployed to Pakistan to help with the. To help with the 9/11 investigation. And I was told that some of you may have seen it also on the news, anthrax was sent to the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad, and a secretary had opened it, and although you trained them, we had trained them in what happens if you do that, and you really set it aside, and freaked out, and, so... Anyways, my mission was to transport this suspected anthrax to the U.S., and that was a very challenging mission for me because I was carrying it, and I was coming to the U.S. not on a military flight, but I was coming on a regular flight, and I was not comfortable doing that. And having it was in a diplomatic pouch and transporting it all the way from Islamabad to the U.S. to be checked to see whether it was real anthrax or not, and sitting next to regular people. So I think, that was a mistake. It shouldn't have happened. We should not be transporting nuclear, biological, or any kind of weapons in a regular jet, in a commercial jet. And, reflecting back on that, I was, angry with 9/11, and I wanted to do anything anybody asked me, and I was part of something that I shouldn't have done, and I'm not proud of doing something like that, because I would have exposed, if something had happened, I would have exposed people to this. And I'm sure as people who travel here in the audience, they would like to know what's in that diplomatic bag. Hopefully it's not nuclear or biological or chemical or any other kind of weapon. So I mentioned that.
Are you still restricted now from traveling in the sense that you have to check in with...
No, all the restrictions have been lifted.
All the restrictions have been lifted,
yes.
Right. So now in a sense that you've regained you know, this sense of freedom, really, the sense of freedom. You can do, you know, so many things now with your life. What are you doing now, Nada Pravi?
Well, I have the hardest job that I've ever had in my life, and I am day to day dealing and learning how to do that, and it's motherhood. As I said earlier, my three-year-old beautiful daughter, because I have some of my in-laws here in the audience, is very challenging, and I am enjoying being a mother, and I have been asked to do some speaking engagements that I'd like to do in the future, and again, if I'm asked to help in the future with help my government, I would do that again. And you mentioned, you know, possibility of the movie, and so that's something that I'm thinking about. And some folks have asked me to write a book too, because I couldn't fit all my cases in one book. So there's a lot of things to look forward to in the future.
And one of the things perhaps in your future is different nicknames in the CIA. Your code name was Miss Sahar, correct?
Yes.
And you called your Colt Commando Bubba or Booba?
Yes. I had a relationship with my automatic weapon. Maybe it's strange, but I did. But I talked to the weapon in the car, and, maybe it's cuckoo, but I'm not cuckoo. I love my weapon. He protected me, and I kept him clean.
Well, and there's an example of how your life has gone through so many incarnations, really, because at one point, I think, because of growing up in war-torn Lebanon, you didn't really want to approach a weapon. In fact, you talk about how it took a long time for you, maybe actually a short time, relatively speaking, to get used to firing weapons. But once you got used to it, you became really good at it.
I did. I was one of the few agents, and some people here had come to my FBI headquarters firearms presentation, and maybe you should ask them how I shot. But yes, absolutely, I enjoyed it. I like challenges. I like challenging things. So when it was psychological, not wanting to use the gun, because I had equated guns with bad things in my past, life growing up in Lebanon. But once I got over that psychological part, I know how to handle weapons.
Final question, perhaps. Looking back at your career in the CIA and FBI, I mean, there are a lot of things that happened in your career. Of course, the political and other things that happened where your career was essentially cut short. But when you're looking back and you talk to your young children, for example, and they ask you about it, is there something, one incident that, or one something, a person that you met that really encapsulates your career, that says to them or anyone who really doesn't know you, this is what it was like, this is kind of a highlight, this is why, I came to this country, this is why I wanted to work for the U.S. government?
One of the stories that is in the book talks about what we used to refer to as STD. It's not the disease. It's SEAL Team Dave. It was a guy who was on the SEAL teams, and we were doing an operation, and we had just dropped off a contact who had given us information. And as soon as we dropped him off in this area, we started taking fire. And STD got his night vision goggles, turned the light off, and drove into one place. And I'm just so proud to have worked with these kind of people, because he looked at me, he said, stay in the bulletproof SUV, I'm going down. And, his sacrifice, just being able to tell me, you stay safe, I'll go down in harm's way where they're shooting at us. And, of course, I had to convince myself, I'm not going to do that. If he gets shot, I'm coming out, and I got all my weapons ready, and I was going to go into, fight in the mission. We eventually get rescued. But it was his look as he opened the door, got his battle rattle, his stuff that he uses, and he took that position. It was the look that he gave me and said, you stay in, safe. And then he said, don't let them take you hostage. I told him, you'll never see the jumpsuit on me, the orange jumpsuit.
That's perhaps a good note to leave on. Our thanks to Nada Prouty. author of the book Uncompromised, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of an Arab-American Patriot in the CIA. We also thank our audiences listening and who can tune in and find out more information at commonwealthclub.org. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.
Thank you all. Thank you all.